happy day.
Oh, happy day.
When Jesus wore.
When Jesus wore.
Oh, when he wore.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have a lot to share today. We're going to talk about sandalwood as an essential oil. I'm going to give you all the reasons why you should be considering using it. And why women should be consuming more tea. This is from the Uppsala University in Sweden. A lot of good it does them. Also, we're going to look at how vitamin C can impact sepsis and the suppression of the truth about vitamin C. And vitamin C therapy delivers life-saving results for people who have septic shock. And that would mean it can save a lot of people from having amputations, which we have a lot of in the United States, especially with gangrene. Also, we'll take a look at higher serum levels of vitamin D associated with lower risk of chronic kidney disease, and a lot more on health and healing. Then I will talk about how the hepatitis B vaccine, according to the latest research, is linked with sudden infant death syndrome and other serious side effects, and it's found to be ineffective in this new study. It is, without question, the most dangerous and worthless of the vaccines. I will also be giving you today a historical look in the Ukraine, in Libya, in Syria, in Honduras, talking about what the countries were like before we decided to invade them and throw away their ruling parties and implant our own. And then I'll show you what they're like today. And the problem is, a lot of so-called liberals or people respected within the liberal community are supporting this. Would they support regime change where we should not be engaged if they knew the truth and if their liberal leaders were advocating about peace instead of invasion? We've been told that that we've got good science in the United States, and indeed we do have some good science. But once again, that science can be impacted by money. We're going to give you how Harvard researchers got hefty sums to downplay the role of sweets in heart disease, and that will be an interesting piece. And also, the economy is recovering, we're told. That's good, but they're not saying we're creating low-paying jobs. And increasingly, these are filled with people with very expensive degrees, and those degrees are not applicable to being in the service industry. So why go to college today? I had an interesting conversation yesterday with a person who's a close friend who is an IT person, had his own company for a long time, had 28 employees, all involved in IT work, and now he has that conversation with his daughter, who's 20 years old, about should you continue on in college if you don't know what you want to do in life, if you don't know what you're passionate about, but it's going to cost a lot of money, and your mother and I are going to have to pay for it. Well, that's a conversation that at least 15 million millennials should have had. Maybe did, maybe didn't. But the outcome is they got college degrees. They don't have jobs that are in anywhere near helping them pay off their college loans, and their parents and grandparents are having their salaries garnished, their Social Security garnished, losing their homes for a degree that they shouldn't have. So I believe as a whole nation, we should just stop this insanity. Stop for a moment. Get off that absolutely hyperkinetic, completely distracting treadmill and say, do the average persons in this country need a college education in order to survive? And the unequivocal answer is no. In fact, if anything, you're far smarter today to postpone going to college and trying to find out who you are, what you really are impassioned by, what skills could you develop to mirror those passions, and are they trade skills that you could learn? Are they interdisciplinary personal skills? So we've always thought the only way you can succeed is by having a college education, and that helps you get ahead. It's simply not true. Unless you are, of course, looking to become a doctor or a nurse, there are certain skills, architect, pilot, yes. But for 70% of all the people going to college, you don't need to go to college. You're much better off doing something that you're impassioned by at this time and not having debt than you are having debt. Nothing you are going to work at that you're impassioned by. Working at McDonald's is not the job career you want. And staying at home, as 55% of all college graduates are today, and in effect, they would be homeless. So that's a conversation we need to have, an honest, open conversation. I'll be doing some of that on upcoming programs. Also today, I'm going to share some commentaries that I believe that America needs to hear. One is from Jim Cavanaugh from Counterpunch, entitled No Laughing Matter, The Manchester Bomber is the Spawn of Hillary and Barack's Excellent Libyan Adventure. Also today, a commentary from Max Blumenthal, person I have a lot of respect for, from Alternet, entitled The Manchester Bombing is Blowback from the West Disasters Interventions and Covert Proxy War. So if that's the case, then what about all the people who call themselves liberal or left or progressive, who supported those interventions? Are they going to take responsibility for the dead, the displaced, the immigrants, the decapitated? If you can't take responsibility for what you're advocating for, which becomes then a way that they support through the political process, well, even the liberals believe that we should be intervening. And then you find out you're wrong. Do any of these people have the capacity to say they're sorry? And how do you say you're sorry to a person whose village was destroyed, whose children were killed, all because of you going in front of a microphone and believing because you're a famous person on the left that somehow you are not responsible for the consequences of what you say? It's time we address this. Today, I'm addressing it. If there's a consequence to it, don't worry, everyone. Every single day, you can hear me where we actually have real free speech radio, and that's the Progressive Radio Network, and you can hear that every day, no matter what else might happen, because there's a possibility after today's show, some of the syndicated stations will say, well, you can't talk about people on the left. Well, screw you, I can. If these people are acting out, if these people are wrong, if being wrong causes other people to die, then they deserve to be called out. And if you don't have the courage to call them out, then you're a coward. Hope I make myself clear. You'll see what I'm talking about later. And if they don't want the show, fine with me. We still have 28 million people who do. Let's go to our issues. Needless to say, I just turned on one of the burners of a 6-burner fire that's going to be roaring in about a half hour. We always start with something that everybody benefits from, and that is health and healing. Very few people pay attention to what are called the essential oils in our country. It's very common elsewhere. In fact, almost in any place you go in India, in Sri Lanka, in Bangladesh, you will see that the people who are living there, mainly poor people, know that they can't always rely upon medicine, so they use different essential oils or use spices in their cooking because it helps them. One of those is sandalwood. Now, according to the Natural Blaze and the latest research, when it comes to looking at this kind of woodsy and earthy aroma that comes from the tree bark, one that comes to mind is sandalwood essential oil. And sandalwood not only has the kind of a unique woodsy sweet smell, It also contains a lot of beneficial phytonutrients. For example, most people are stressed out and become overwhelmed from the pressures of everyday life. Sandalwood's essential oil is known for calming people down and having overall well-being. It's also a natural aphrodisiac, a memory booster. It has anti-inflammatory properties. And sandalwood's essential oil has traditionally been used for meditation, religious rituals, and even embalming purposes in ancient Egypt. Sandalwood is made from a sandalwood tree, which is considered holy and used for certain religious ceremonies, such as the birth of a baby and decorations at weddings. And the highest quality sandalwood is from India, and it's called Santalum album. In Australia and Hawaii also has different varieties of sandalwood, but the purity and quality are not thought to be the same as the one from India, which is also the most expensive essential oil in the market. So when you're getting your sandalwood, demand the best from India because it has the best oil. It also comes from immature trees, from very mature trees, because most of the other trees are immature and are being cut before that sandalwood oil has had a chance to fully mature. In fact, a sandalwood tree, if you've ever seen one, it goes about 50 feet high once it's mature, and takes about 80 years before sandalwood roots can be harvested. And the aroma of sandalwood essential oil is stronger when the tree has the chance to properly mature. And steam distillation is the procedure used to extract the oil. So what do we know it can do? What's the actual scientific literature show? Well, a whole lot. The best known benefits of sandalwood, aside from the ones I mentioned, is that it improves mental health and memory. It also has been used for sore throats, urinary and chest infections, herpes simplex. It is also a natural antiviral, antiseptic, anti-inflammatory, antispasmodic. It's astringent, it is hypotensive, it's diuretic, it's carminative, it is tonic, it is a disinfectant, and it's an expectorant. So it has all these qualities, and it also helps treat endometriosis, and which is a very painful condition. So, and that's where skin from the uterus grows outside the uterus, and endometriosis can also cause fertility problems. So using 3 drops of sandalwood essential oil each day can help decrease the inflammation and pain associated with that. So it helps balance hormones, especially testosterone hormone in both women and men. And as a result, sandalwood is a natural aphrodisiac that's been used for a long time. So some things to think about. Again, always good to have something that can help us. Now, one of the things that's inexpensive and easy to use are teas, especially green tea. There's new research published in the Journal of Human Molecular Genetics that shows that epigenetic changes, which this audience knows are chemical modifications that turn our genes on or off, and even the sound of someone's voice can impact a gene. A calming voice can turn the genes on to heal, to stimulate the immune system, to relax, to de-stress. Anger, rage, yelling, that turns them off, and therefore you're actually in a process where you can constrict, which is not good. If you notice, anytime you get fearful, all the muscles constrict, the neck constricts, the voice constricts, the breathing constricts. So epigenetics can be influenced by the sounds around us. That's why anyone that I counsel who is highly stressed, I ask them to get themselves a tape. There are any number of them. There are thousands of running water, like a waterfall or a thunderstorm or waves coming in on the shore. These are very calming, and that can actually turn on the healing of the genes. And certain smells, for example, cinnamon is a good smell that reminds us of the innocence and simplicity of our childhood. And lavender is a wonderful smell. Putting 3 drops of lavender on your pillow at night can help you sleep better. So, simple things. Well, it's well known that our environment, lifestyle factors such as our food choices and the chemicals in our environment can lead to epigenetic changes, but those are negative changes. When the current study, researchers from Uppsala University in Sweden investigated tea, and they found that it leads to epigenetic changes, good ones, modulating disease risk in humans by suppressing tumor progression and decreasing inflammation and influencing estrogen metabolism that can be mediated in a positive way. And it's interesting because many of these epigenetic changes were found in genes involving cancer and estrogen metabolism. Quote, previous studies have shown that tea consumption reduces estrogen levels, which highlights a potential difference between the biological response to tea in men and women. The men didn't get the benefit, the women did. Quote, women also drink higher amounts of tea compared to men, which increases our power to find association in women. So this was at the Department of Immunology, Genetics, and Pathology. So the takeaway message is this. It's relatively simple. The more green tea that you consume, the greater chance you have to positively turn on genes that modulate breast cancer, ovarian cancer, and overall good health. And also, household chemicals can impair your thyroid, especially if you're a young girl. Now, these are thiolates, and they're linked to the depressed function of the master controller of the brain in development and potentially explaining known related cognitive problems, especially in young people. We think of cognition problems in older adults. Historically, yes. But we are now facing children being born and exposed to over 100,000 human-made toxins in the environment, in the drinking water like fluoride and medicines that are in the water. In fact, it's become so common they don't even talk about it anymore. All of the medicines from chemotherapy and statins and tranquilizers, when they exit the body through feces and urine, they go into the water to be purified. However, these molecules are so small, they go right through the purification process and end up in your drinking water. And so we consume them. So the idea is the issue of pollution is dilution. That's no longer true. Meaning, we thought if as long as you had a part per million, that's not a whole lot. Yet is. Even parts per billion. Let me give you one example. If you had an Olympic swimming pool, and you took one eyedropper, and you took one single drop from an eyedropper, and you drop that into an Olympic swimming pool full with water, the entire pool is contaminated. That's parts per billion. So we have to rethink nanotechnology and what we're exposed to. So Columbia University School of Public Health published in Environmental International, talked about how early childhood exposure to specific toxins can end up depressing the thyroid gland, and then as the kid grows, they end up having all these endocrine problems. And so before, some children were getting overweight, and it wasn't because they were overeating, they had a malfunctioning thyroid. Or they could have a malfunctioning thyroid that goes from being too slow to too fast. So no matter how much they eat, they stay skinny. And then when they don't have constant food, they get weak, and they get spacey. Now remember, your thyroid acts as the master controller of brain development, and thyroid hormones set the schedule. And if the timing is out of sync, there may be later consequences in the brain. And the thyroid disruptions we can see can happen when your kid is exposed to lead, even small exposures to different chemicals. So mercury, lead, cadmium, all these airborne pollutants, they're bad for kids. And finally, from Griffith University in Australia, the world's first long-term assessment of mental health effects from adolescents' late-night mobile use has shown bad results. Research conducted at the University in Australia tracked changes in late-night mobile phone use, sleep, and mental health indicators over a 3-year period in this very large a sample of Australian teens, they found that adolescents' late-night mobile use or cell phone use was directly linked to poor quality sleep, which subsequently led to poor mental health outcomes, reduced coping, and lowered self-esteem. So, what do you do? Well, if you care about your kid, take away the cell phone. They shouldn't have them anyhow. And have no computers, no electronic devices that have electromagnetic pulses coming from them. Put your kid to bed at a certain time. If they throw a temper tantrum, fine. But the whole idea is kids are very smart. They're neither innocent nor are they honest. The moment they see it by crying, yelling, screaming, biting, hitting, kicking, spilling, smudging, crapping, they can get their way, then the parent relents and lets them have it. Bad parenting. There's a point to where you're not there as a parent to be the best friend of your kids so they love you for life. They won't. You're there to help the child develop some specific skills and disciplines so that they can evolve as proper human beings in a society. So this whole idea that they'll go to bed when they want, they'll sleep when they want, they'll take whatever they want to bed, they'll eat when they want, drink when they want, and they're 4 years old. Man, just think what they're going to be like when they graduate from high school. Well, they're not going to have a really good brain because that cell phone use is a real problem. Quote, heavy mobile phone use becomes a problem when it overtakes essential aspects of adolescent life. Yeah, I remember growing up. I'm sure some of you do. Mom said, time to go to bed. You didn't argue. You went to bed. All right. You might not have wanted to go to bed because especially if you're young and you're thinking, well, someone else is still awake. They're out there doing something. I'm not. Why am I not out there having fun with them? So you might have resented, but you also, you know, you realize that there are boundaries you don't cross if you respect elders and especially your parents and you have some sense of discipline. Google discipline today. It doesn't exist. You know, so if something doesn't exist anywhere in your life, then exactly how is it supposed to benefit you? The entire younger generation lacks discipline, with some exception. That's unfortunate. But for your kid, if you don't help that kid by taking away the cell phone at night, it's affecting their brain. What are you going to do later when they're diagnosed with attention deficit disorder or learning disorder? And you have to now watch your kid suffer. It's not worth it. Protect your kid, even if they don't like you for a split second. How many times have we heard, I hate you. I wish you were dead. And then slamming the door as loud as it can. And then 5 minutes later, I need your credit card. I'm going to the mall. Like, okay. No, we've all been through that. Be disciplined in a good way and with explanations and understanding, and some will accept and some will reject it, and that's fine. At least you've done what you know is important, because kids don't have the maturity yet to understand what's good for them. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Standing here looking at you.
That's Little Anthony and the Imperials. Some of you might remember, about 1,500 of you might remember, I hired him and Jackie Mason and Dick Shawn to be the entertainment at a health retreat we did at Grossinger's years ago. And he still had the voice, still has it. And that's why I like to go to the doo-wop shows when they're in town. I have some really interesting guests coming up. For example, tomorrow we're going to talk about living deliberately, what we can learn from the lives of monks and ascetics, and how it will help us deal with existential despair for an uncertain future ahead. My guest will be Professor Justin McDaniel, one of the leading scholars in religion for the next generation. He's the chairman of the Department of Religious Studies, University of Pennsylvania, and professor of Buddhism. Very iconoclastic. And then we have Professor Timothy Snyder, chair of the Department of History at Yale University, one of America's most respected historians. And we're going to talk about recounting and analyzing the Ukraine crisis. And I believe that we have been lied to. We have proof we've been lied to. And they're going to go into great depth on this. And so we have a lot of interesting guests coming up. One of the things we're told all the time, look how good the economy is. Look how low unemployment is. Yeah, that's a completely artificial, fraudulent figure. The real unemployment level in the United States is about 22 to 24%. Don't take my word for it. Just look at the actual way they calculate the figures and say, hold on a second. There are 102 million Americans who once worked, who could work, would like to work, and work full-time, and are not included in your unemployment figure. How do you do that alchemy? And they'll give you some nonsense, and people say, okay, why doesn't the New York Times, 60 Minutes, 2020 Dateline, why don't they do an expose of how, if we showed how much unemployment we have, we'd be right up there with Spain, with Greece. Wouldn't make us look good. And our debt is the highest in the world. And a highest debt against gross domestic product means we're bankrupt, totally bankrupt as a nation. Well, we're also the one nation that controls the dollar. We control economies. And so we live with myth. So this is the latest from Campus Progress from Amber Pace. Quote, the Department of Labor released new job market numbers which suggest that the economic recovery is perpetuating the trend of college graduates turning to minimum wage jobs. Though there have been significant employment gains, most recent college graduates have been forced to resort to low-wage, low-skilled jobs. There are now 13.4 million college graduates working for hourly pay. That's up 19% since the start of the recession. According to the Department of Labor, and they go into how many low-paying jobs there are, so yeah, people are getting jobs out of college, low-pay jobs. This is from CNN Money from Tammy Luby, and says America's most common jobs come with lousy pay. This is a separate article. Quote, workers in 7 of the 10 largest occupations today typically earn less than $30,000 a year, according to data published by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That's a far cry from the nation's average annual pay of $45,790. Food prep workers are the third most common job in the United States, but have the lowest pay at a mere $18,720 a year. Cashiers and waiters are also popular professions, but the average pay for these job tallies less than $21,000 a year. There are 4.3 million retail sales workers out there, making them the most common job in the United States, but the position pays only $25,310 a year. Among the 10 most popular professions, only the nation's 2.6 million registered nurses earn a good living, bringing in about $68,000 a year on average. Another two of the most common jobs, secretaries and customer service representatives, have an average annual income of $33,000. So, how in the world can anyone say, look how good things are going? Yeah. And you've got someone who's working two jobs in order just to pay rent or mortgage or buy food. I think we have to have an honest discussion about how the entire economy has failed people. And finally, I want to talk about something about science. I can remember a debate. First, I had a debate with the person who was head of the American Council on Science and Health, which is a very, very pro big pharma, big sugar, big corporate interest, which is fine. That's their right. That's where they got their money, and that's where their allegiance is. And we debated national television, and we debated the topic of sugar. It was on the Bob Kane Show on NBC. And I had the studies that show that sugar in the common amount consumed was leading to cancers, heart disease, all types of disease, diabetes. And the other person said, well, that's not true. And so anyhow, I then asked to debate Dr. Frederick Stare, who was also dubbed the Cornflakes Professor. He got a lot of money from the sugar industry and products made from sugary foods. And it was all set. It was to be a national debate, and we were all hooked up. And Barry Farber was through the moderator, and because I didn't feel it would be fair to be a moderator and the person debating, and he didn't show up. So there we are live on the air. So I just went ahead and did my discussion on sugar. Little did I know, little did anyone know, that while I was out there debating on sugar and trying to get people to realize how dangerous it was, governmental agencies were in disagreement. No, they didn't think sugar was bad. I even cornered the commissioner of the FDA, the head of the National Cancer Institute, Senator Proxmire and Rogers and a lot of others. I went to Washington and I said, why aren't you dealing with the dangers of sugar in the American diet? And Proxmire was very honest with me. He said, it's all about who gives you the money. He said, I'm from Wisconsin, the dairy state, and so you don't do anything, it hurts the dairy industry. That's what he told me on film. At least he was honest. And the head of the National Cancer Institute was also very honest, a person of high integrity, and he said, we know that diet is responsible for a lot of cancer, if not the majority. Now, try to change people and try to change the industry. Neither one is going to change. And I came away kind of saddened that, gee whiz, if something's killing people, wouldn't they voluntarily want to change? And spending my whole life seeing people who are smarter than the choices they've made, and then one day those choices come home to rest and they end up with a heart attack or a stroke or cancer or diabetes or amputation. And you think, wow, what if Harvard would have been more honest? Here's the latest. This is from Beth Mole, M-O-L-E, from Ars Technica. It says, sugar industry bought off scientists, skewed dietary guidelines for decades. Harvard researchers got hefty sums to downplay role of sweets in heart disease. Quote, back in the 1960s, a sugar industry executive wrote fat checks to a group of Harvard researchers so they'd downplay the links between sugar and heart disease in a prominent medical journal. And researchers did it, according to historical documents reported in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine. One of those Harvard researchers went on to become the head of the nutrition at the United States Department of Agriculture, where he set the stage for the federal government's current dietary guidelines. All in all, the corrupted researchers and skewed scientific literature successfully helped draw attention away from the health risks of sweets and shift the blame solely to fats. For nearly 50 years, the low-fat, high-sugar diets that health experts subsequently encouraged are now seen as a main driver of the current obesity epidemic. The bitter revelations came from archived documents from the Sugar Research Foundation, now the Sugar Association, dug up by researchers at the University of California, San Francisco. Their dive into the old sour affair highlights both the perils of trusting industry-sponsored research to inform policy and the importance of requiring scientists to disclose conflicts of interest, something that didn't become the norm until years later. Perhaps most strikingly, it spotlights the concerning power of the sugar industry. Quote, these findings, our analysis, and current Sugar Association criticisms of evidence linking sucrose to cardiovascular disease suggest the industry may have a long history of influencing federal policy, the authors conclude. Okay, well, how about this? How about going back and holding all those people accountable, if not through legally because of the statute of limitations? But how about ethically? How about doing a whole rogues gallery of corporate leaders who knowingly bribed or in some way financially influenced researchers in every industry and say, these are the people that put profits ahead of people's lives, and people suffered. Millions have suffered from diabetes, heart disease, and other associated conditions. These people should not be able to stay in academia. They should not be respected leaders of business. So even when someone is exposed, now mind you, this is the same time that those of us who are telling the truth are being called quacks, because we were showing the truth. We couldn't, our integrity, our ethics were so high, unlike the average scientist, the average physician, the average nurse, the average public health official, that would not be influenced by the nature of their own personal security. They sought the truth. And if it was a bitter lesson, so be it. It's not for us to in some way, sanitize, pasteurize, homogenize, blanderdize, and to give it to a public or a scientific community or to a media that doesn't want something that's going to impact their advertising in the media? Could you imagine how bad the science is with all psychiatric drugs? The entire psychiatric profession is a fraud. There's no legitimacy in it. It's about pharmacology, giving a false diagnosis of a condition that does not exist, social anxiety disorder, parental defiance disorder. These are not real. There's no science behind these. And then giving drugs. And then the government, through Medicare and Medicaid, paying for these drugs. And then teachers believing they're smart enough to be doctors and diagnosing a kid, a little Jimmy, who may be bored because you're not a good teacher. Maybe the course, you're a good teacher, but the course is boring. Maybe Jimmy doesn't want to just study for tests. He actually wants to learn something rare in American education, how to be a critical thinker. My God, you could go to half the universities in this country and half the schools in this country, and you'd be in a wasteland searching for critical thinking teachers and students who are there to prepare themselves. But studying for a test to get good grades that then make everyone seem good, yeah, that's everywhere. So what do we do with these kids? We give them an artificial diagnosis, and then we give them a drug, and then we come home one afternoon, they're hanging, they kill themselves. And we just think, oh, wonder what happened. The number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-old boys is suicide. When I was growing up, there was never a suicide. Why? Because we didn't have artificial diagnosis. You went to the doctor, he sat with you, and you talked. Or you went to a priest, you went to someone who was someone you respected, and they gave you an insight that could help you resolve some of your issues of life that we all face. Today, it's all about following the money. So you take the money out of medicine, you can actually begin over to have legitimate medicine. You have to change the paradigm. That's why we should have universal health care. Eliminate all insurance companies. Take all the profit out of medicine. Make a nonprofit. And allow those companies who are producing drugs to have 100% markup. That's a legitimate markup. Go to a furniture store, a car dealership, go into a grocery store, go into a juice bar, go into a bookstore, they would be happy to have 100% markup. Well, if they can survive on 100% markup, why can't a pharmaceutical company so that you don't go broke getting a drug? We did an expose in the War on Health and show that the average generic cost for a 30-day supply of drugs, let's say you get 30 pills in a bottle, their cost was as low as 10 cents, 10 pennies, charging as much as $230 for the same bottle. When you're dealing in 20, 30, 40, 100, 200,000% profit, the highest was 500,000% profit from the generic cost to the manufacturer for 30-day supply versus what they were charging. You have an entirely corrupted system. Everyone in it's going to be influenced from the drug detail people. Do you ever notice they never get older people and they never get ugly people? They always get these really dynamite-looking young men and women who go up and say, "Hi, I'm your new drug rep. I'm going to make your staff lunch. And oh, by the way, you and your wife, it's on us. Choose your restaurant and we're paying for it. Oh, and I heard that you like golf. What if we send you to Hawaii first class to play golf for a week? You just have to attend some, you know, ridiculous and phony a continuing education seminar. That's just the screen that we put on it. You're really there to have us influence you and in effect bribe you. The entire system of medicine is wrong. Every system is wrong. We don't have a legitimate system in the United States. We are so corrupt at every level. And we're not honest about it. And one of the reasons we can't be honest is because the media is not honest about anything. And what we used to believe is there were honest people in the media. They were, but they're not a part of mainstream media anymore. Chris Hedges, honest guy. Yep. We've had Glenn Ford, honest guy. But go to CNN, go to MSNBC, go to Fox. Now find me the honest reporter. Find me the reporters willing to do an expose on a drug that is being advertised on the air that the drug company would take off the air, along with seven other drugs they advertise on your program. And let's just see how that works. See how long you keep your job. We just can't be honest. And this is, brings me to my last point before we go to our guest, hepatitis B vaccine. This is from Dr. McCullough, quote, by the time your newborn is 12 hours old, federal health officials recommend administering the first dose of hepatitis B vaccine 12 hours. If you want to avoid it, you must make it very clear to all hospital staff well before the delivery and monitor your baby closely until you leave the hospital. Three hepatitis B shots are part of the standard government recommended childhood vaccine schedule, with a third dose to be given before 18 months of age. But hepatitis B is primarily a blood-transmitted adult disease associated with risky lifestyle choices such as unprotected sex with multiple partners and intravenous drug use involving shared needles. It is not primarily a childhood disease. In fact, according to the National Vaccine Information Center, quote, the primary reason the CDC recommended hepatitis B vaccination for all newborns in the United States in 1991 is because public health officials and doctors could not persuade adults in high-risk groups, primarily IV drug users and persons with multiple sexual partners, to get the vaccine. But now new research has shown that by the time a child reaches his or her teenage years, the time when acquiring a hepatitis B infection may be more likely, the protection from the childhood vaccine is long gone. And then it goes on to talk about what it does to a kid, a baby. All bad. And there's no good science behind any of these vaccines, as you will see shortly in a new special I have. Taking a break, coming right back, we have a lot to get into. Stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you, and Sunday, 9 o'clock, 5th Avenue and 90th Street in Central Park. For those of you who wanted to get in good shape, you'll be there, I'll be there, all of our coaches will be there. Our coaches are meeting at 8 o'clock to do our hard runs so we can do a slow workout with you and get you into good shape. 90th and 5th, it's free, it's a public service. I'm concerned, as I know many of you are, that we have become a nation engaged in imperial overreach. Our hegemony is apparent to everyone in the world, but the average American is not aware. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you just an example of what happens when we go into a country, the media is not being diligent, and it accepts the propaganda from the White House and Congress and the CIA and National Security Agency, that we have this evil person and we must get rid of him. And to bring democracy, freedom, and peace to a country. And yet we seem to have amnesia. We're not looking back. We're not looking at places like Iraq or Afghanistan and what happened there. And I'm going to share the words of two individuals who I believe have really nailed this. One is Max Blumenthal, an article in Alternet called The Manchester Bombing is Blowback from the West Disastrous Interventions and Covert Proxy Wars. The other is from Jim Cavanaugh from Counterpunch. And the article is No Laughing Matter. The Manchester Bomber is the spawn of Hillary and Barack's excellent Libyan adventure. And then I'm going to give you some of the latest statistics after I give you their comments and my own commentary. First, from Jim Cavanaugh. On November 20, 2015, two jihadi militants attacked the Radisson Blue Hotel in Bamako, Mali, seizing about 100 hostages and leaving bodies strewn across the building. When it was over, 22 people, including the attackers, had been killed, as the New York Times reported. Not much has been made in America or Western media of this attack. Most of the dead were people from Mali and Russians and Chinese, and we think, all right, that just happens. especially over there. How many people hearing this even remember that this happened? Follow-up analysis, it was Africa. That kind of coverage is rarely reported. Last Monday, jihadi suicide bomber Salman Abedi blew himself up at the Ariana Grande concert in Manchester, England, killing 22 people. He grew up in a anti-Qaddafi Libyan immigrant family. In 2011, his father, Ramadan Abedi, along with other British Libyans, including one who was under house arrest, quote, was allowed to go to Libya, no questions asked, to join the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, or the LIFG, an al-Qaeda affiliate to help overthrow Qaddafi. In Manchester, as Max Blumenthal puts it in his excellent alternate piece, it was all, quote, part of the rat line operated by M15, that's the equivalent of the CIA in Great Britain, which hustled anti-Qaddafi Libyan exiles to the front lines of the war. In Manchester, Salman lived near a number of these militants, including an expert bomb maker. This was a tough bunch, and everyone, including the cops and Salman's Muslim neighbors, knew they weren't the jets and the sharks. And as Middle East Eye reports, quote, he was known to security services and someone of who was anti, he was a terrorist. Now, could this be any clearer? The Abedi family was part of a protected cohort of Salafist proxy soldiers that had been used by the West, meaning the United States and France and Italy and Great Britain, to destroy the Libyan state. There are a number of such cohorts around the world that have been used for decades to overthrow relatively prosperous and secular but insufficiently compliant governments in the Arab and Muslim world. And members of those groups have perpetuated several blowback attacks in Western countries via various winding roads. In this case, the direct line from Libya to Mali to Manchester is particularly easy to trace. Too bad more people in Britain and the West hadn't paid attention to what happened in Mali 2 years ago. Too bad they hadn't thought too much about the chain of jihadi proxy interventions that the United States and its allies, or about the connection with the chain of jihadi attacks in Western countries. Too bad they hadn't recognized the continuing arrogance of the West, U.S., NATO, and the Middle East, the Gulf states and Israel, powers who think they can unleash and releash these jihadi fighters at will. Too bad they don't understand the contradiction between mourning the bombing of Manchester and crying for the bombing of Syria. Too bad the Western and American-directed media don't provide what would be necessary to understand these things. Ongoing coverage and analysis of the obvious relations between the continuing series of horrors perpetrated by jihadi militants and the continuing series of horrors perpetrated by Western and allied governments. It's a good bet nobody will have forgotten the Manchester bombing 2 years from now. It was in merry old England, after all, and many of the victims were beautiful British girls. It's also a good bet that the media analysis will continue to have everyone scratching their heads about why these death-loving Muslims hate us so much. That kind of coverage, the jihadi attackers in Mali and the jihadi bomber in Manchester, were direct products, not accidental byproducts, but deliberately incubated protégés of American, British, French, NATO regime change in Libya, a project that was executed by the Obama administration and spearheaded by Hillary Clinton. But before the Glorious Revolution, Libya under Qaddafi had the highest standard of living of any country in Africa, according to the United Nations Human Development Index. And before the jihadi onslaught backed by NATO bombing campaign, Qaddafi's Libya was an anchor of stability in North Africa. As even the United States and British governments knew and acknowledged, per a 2008 cable from American Foreign Service officer Christopher Stevens, who would later be the ambassador, published by WikiLeaks, quote, Libya, this is according to the ambassador, Libya has been a strong partner in the war against terrorism, and cooperation in liaison channels is excellent. Muammar Gaddafi's criticism of Saudi Arabia for perceived support of Wahhabi extremism, a source of continuing Libyan-Saudi tension, reflects broader Libyan concern about the threat of extremism. Worried that fighters returning from Afghanistan and Iraq could destabilize the regime, the government of Libya has aggressively pursued operations to disrupt foreign fighting there, including more strident monitoring of air and land ports of entry and blunt the ideological appeal of radical Islam, end quote. The British, French, NATO supposed humanitarian intervention put an end to that by overthrowing the Libyan government under entirely phony pretext, in contravention of fundamental international law and in violation of the United Nations resolution they claimed as a justification. The executioners and beneficiaries of that aggression were the jihadists who have been rampaging from Mali to Manchester. It's a very bright, clear line. Gaddafi himself warned Tony Blair that, quote, an organization of terrorists has laid down sleeper cells in North Africa called the Al-Qaeda Organization in North Africa. Gaddafi's son, Saif, warned that overthrowing Libya would make the country, quote, the Somalia of North Africa, of the Mediterranean, and you will see millions of illegal immigrants. The terror will be next door. Well, thanks to Tony Blair and Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton and Sarkozy, that's exactly what happened. Libya was destroyed as a functioning state, and the terror is now inside every Western door. So, that's part of the article. There is more. And now, and that was from Jim Cavanaugh. And there is an equally important article by Max Blumenthal, and I'll just share a couple paragraphs. The heinous suicide bombing of British-born Salman Abedi of an Ariana Grande concert in Manchester was not merely the work of an evil loser, as Donald Trump called it. It was blowback from interventionist policies carried out in the name of human rights and civilian protection through wars of regime change and the arming of, and training of Islamic proxy groups. The United States, United Kingdom, and France played out imperial delusions across the Middle East, in Syria and Libya. They cultivated the perfect petri dish for jihadist insurgency, helping to spawn weaponized nihilists like this young guy, intent on bringing the West wars back home. And he goes on to talk about that man and his background, all of which was known to British intelligence and Western intelligence also. Now, also he talks about the fact that Gaddafi was working with all the intelligence agencies in Europe and the United States. Quote, in March 1998, Gaddafi's Libya became the first country to issue an Interpol arrest warrant for bin Laden. The warrant was studiously ignored by American and British intelligence, according to French journalist Jean-Charles Brissard, an advisor to French President Jacques Chirac. 5 months later, Al-Qaeda struck the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Among the participants in the attack was Al-Libi and Ali Mohammed, a spy for Al-Qaeda leader Zawahiri, who had entered the United States on a CIA-approved visa and managed to rise to the rank of corporal at the John F. Kennedy School of Special Warfare at Fort Bragg, where he smuggled special forces training manuals out to Al-Qaeda cadres. So it goes on to talk about how so we understand Gaddafi was trying to warn everyone, and he had the strongest policy around against all of these terrorists. And then what happened? Gaddafi was not engaged in terrorism. He had the number one educational system in the entire area of the world. Very quickly, he had, as examples, free education and free housing and a guaranteed job, or you would be paid what a guaranteed job would have given you. Women had the highest rights of any Muslim country in the world. And women were equal. Women could get divorced. Women could choose their career. Women could not be discriminated against. You couldn't say anything bad about a woman. And there was the largest number of democratically elected groups in Libya's country than any other country in the world. So it was number one in prosperity, number one in education, number one in longevity. You live longer in Gaddafi's Libya than you did in the United States, England, or France, the very countries that would try to destroy it. They had the lowest infant mortality, and all this was destroyed. They had no debt. They had no terrorism. It was the Paris of Africa. And this was noted. This was not a secret. So when you want regime change, it's not because you want to bring prosperity and democracy and freedom to a country. It's because you want the resources, in this case, oil. And you want people who are compliant to your needs. You want people you can subordinate. That's why we were there. The problem is not that Obama and Clinton engaged in this, the neocons in Washington. It's the fact that even liberals, people who are indeed liberal on some issues, but on others, they supported this, like Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman. So I believe it's time that those people calling themselves liberal or progressive stop and ask, are they willing to be responsible for all the carnage that has occurred in a country where they promoted regime change? I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Sometimes I get a good feeling, yeah. Yeah.